me pones un ejemplo. Entonces, si tú no quieres hablar conmigo, dímelo para yo no llamarte ni molestarte, porque nada más quedaba tú.
Real talk. Real people. Real stories. The He's Just podcast. Yeah! Welcome, everyone, to another He's Just podcast. I'm your host and founder of the He's Just a Social Worker movement with another amazing show for you today. But before we get started, I want to remind everyone that this platform was built because way too often as people, we were overlooked or labeled. But this is no longer our plight, and our fight is for anyone and everyone who needs to be understood. We are strong as individuals, but unstoppable when we unite. Meet Dr. John Berger. He is a senior research fellow at the Pacific Institute. He is a graduate of Stanford and the University of California. He has read over 100 articles on climate change and transitioning to clean energy. His new book, Solving the Climate Crises, Frontline Reports from the Race to Save the Earth, delves into the urgent need for collective action to address the escalating climate crisis. Berger emphasizes the power of individual commitment and the crucial role of collaborative government action in combating climate change. His insights cover several key dimensions: the technological, ecological, and the social dimension. His call to action speaks to the necessity for government and organization to implement policies that can help us reduce carbon emissions while promoting sustainable practices. Dr. Berger's call to action is clear. Saving our planet requires everyone to join forces. Combining individual efforts, technological advancements, ecological preservation, and collective government actions. By uniting these efforts, we can ensure a safer, more sustainable future for our planet. Dr. Berger, welcome to our show.
Thank you very much indeed for inviting me, and thank you for that kind introduction, Jules.
Such a pleasure. I'm excited about today's show. Let's just get started. Tell us a little bit about how you got involved into this work. Tell us about your journey and your walk.
Well, my journey has been a long one because I became interested in problems having to do with energy back in the 1970s. And I wrote my first book on energy in the mid-1970s, and it was a book that warned about the dangers of nuclear power. And I, in that book, also wrote about alternatives to coal and to nuclear power, because back in those days, we were told that the only alternative to having coal power plants all over the landscape was to have 1,000 nuclear power plants all across the United States. And I knew from some of the important work that was done by Critical Mass Energy Project and by the Union of Concerned Scientists that there were serious economic problems, serious safety problems, serious nuclear proliferation problems, and serious problems having to do with terrorism and the potential that terrorists could take over a nuclear power plant. And we have seen that today in the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant in Ukraine, where the Russians have seized the Ukrainian power plant and put it into a perilous condition. But I digress, and I have about 40 more years to explain my journey, and I'll try to telescope it and just say that I've had three phases to my career. One phase had to do with focusing on environmental restoration and how to repair damaged natural ecosystems. Another phase had to do with the issue of clean energy and how can we provide all of the energy that we need in society from the sun, the wind, the earth in the form of geothermal power, wave energy in some cases, a few instances of tidal power, and then clean energy storage using batteries to store solar and wind power, which are intermittent, but to put them aside until they're needed in a form that they can be either converted to electricity. In other words, save the energy as heat or save the energy in an electrical form. So I had sort of a second phase focusing on clean energy, and I wrote a number of things, notably a book called Charging Ahead, The Business of Renewable Energy and What It Means for America. And I was teaching at a community college in the early 1980s, and I became interested in climate change and became somewhat alarmed by the potential impacts of unrestrained burning of fossil fuels and unbridled, if you will, climate change. So I introduced that topic to my students, and then I followed it in successive years, and I watched for 35 years or so as scientists have sounded increasingly strident, if not frantic, alarms about the disruption of the climate system on which we all depend. And I've watched political leaders kind of play footsie with this issue. I've watched the fossil fuel industry basically try to obfuscate the issue and deny it. And this kind of led to the third and current phase of my career, which has been focusing on trying to first raise the alarm about the dangers of climate change, and then secondarily, but more importantly now, to point the way to solutions to address this very complicated and now almost intractable problem, because we've let it fester for at least 40 years, and oil companies have known about the impacts of the pollution from the burning of fossil fuels, but we have been in a sort of political gridlock with some little tinkering around the edges, and we've recently had good legislation in the form of the Inflation Reduction Act. But by and large, we have been pursuing a course of business as usual, and we're now in an emergency situation. So that's kind of a very short little overview of how I got to focus on climate. I saw that it unified my previous issue interests in the issue of environmental restoration and in clean energy, because clean energy being the answer to the climate crisis.
But can you tell us a little bit, Dr. Berger, about what are some of the positives that you can share with us, or some improvements, if you will, we as people that we have done through your trajectory in, you know, the future and saving our planet? What are some of those things?
Well, as a result of the Inflation Reduction Act, which the Biden administration passed in 2022, they appropriated $369 billion for a smorgasbord of things, which included tax credits to encourage electric vehicles and to encourage the construction of solar power and wind power. And I think as a result of that, there have been 646 new projects in 47 states all over the United States to implement clean technology and to use a combination of public and private capital in order to build manufacturing, to create, for example, batteries for electric vehicles or technology needed for solar and wind or geothermal. And we've made great strides in getting to the brink of advanced geothermal power that can extract heat and then electricity even from hot rock, which is pervasive pretty much anywhere underground. There are some areas where it's closer to the surface and more optimal. So the Inflation Reduction Act is one good thing that we can do. And there's a great deal more awareness now about the climate crisis, but we are still not really mobilized as a nation, and we need to have a national mobilization. This is really now, after 40 years of basic neglect, an all hands on deck situation. In our own personal sphere of influence, what we can do is when we make a large energy purchase, we should make sure that it's as efficient as possible. We should try to use as much of the clean, sustainable technology as possible. And when we're buying a traditional appliance, like a washer, a dryer, a dishwasher, things that use, or refrigerator that use lots of energy, we should try and buy the very most efficient electrical appliance that we can. And if we're able to, we should use a heat pump in our home because it has sort of a coefficient of performance is the term of art that is used, which means that for every unit of electricity that you put in, you can mine maybe 3 or even 4 units of heat or cool from the ground or from the outside of the house. And then we should be using maximum insulation. So these are the things that we can do in our home. And we also need to right size our home so that we don't have a huge McMansion that we're trying to heat and cool when it's largely empty of people. And also that we're not driving a huge gas-guzzling car that was maybe designed to carry 6 people or 8 people when all we're going to do is run around from the house to the grocery store or maybe, you know, 10 miles and back to work, because 80% of all of the trips that we take are under 10 miles in length, maybe even under 5. I don't know the exact figure. So we need to avoid wasting energy, and we should use it as thriftily as possible. We should make the decisions about our big energy purchase, like what kind of house, what kind of car we choose. We should make those energy efficient, and if possible, make them renewable. In other words, an electric vehicle if we can afford it and if it fits our needs, or a hybrid, because as I said, most of our journeys are very, very short. It's just a very small fraction of the time are we going really long distances where we need to go 300 miles at a stretch.
Well, so, you know, for me personally, definitely this is an area of growth for me as I begin to sound very like many of the people who are listening to our show could be, you know, novices to this as well. But however, I believe that I've made an effort throughout the years to systematically think about ways that I can, you know, save energy, buying energy efficient kind of refrigerator, washing machine, and appliances, if you will, which are the things that we most consider. The thing about the vehicles, and I would say that they have made a vast improvement, the car makers, and making opportunities happen where people are purchasing vehicles that are energy efficient and improving the environment, but now the vehicles look more appealing. And I think that the car makers are investing more into it. And like you said, if you can afford it, because some of these electrical kind of vehicles, and they're difficult to kind of sell and have, but I think it's more about the people that they're trying to sell it to. And I believe that there's a bracket around age that people may or may not know about that looks or may not feel appealing. But I think that there is some progress, at least in my eyes. I've noticed that car makers, even including bigger names like Lexus and Mercedes-Benz and so on, they have invested or put their names into the hat. So I find that to be positives. In thinking about some of the challenges, there are some things that I believe are still difficult in this area. I know that you've done extensive work in climate preservation. What remains a challenge, even though that you've done years and years upon years of work and traveling around this, what is still challenging?
I think the biggest challenge is that we now essentially have all of the technology we need in order to provide for all of our energy needs cleanly from the renewable sources, but we are not actually implementing it. So the challenge is political, to actually awaken our fellow citizens and get them politically engaged on this issue so that they push the politicians to do the right thing. I'm assuming that we're going to have a Democratic administration in the White House next January, because if we don't, then all talk about progress on the climate issue can be tossed aside. It will be impossible if there were anything other than the Harris administration in the White House. But if they do take over, then we as a people need to bestir ourselves, and we need to create a groundswell of political pressure for much, much more rapid transition to 100% clean energy. We cannot wait till 2050 until we zero out our greenhouse gas emissions, because right now we have the highest concentration of climate-disturbing greenhouse gases in the atmosphere of any time in the past 4 million years, and it has been hottest in the past month of any time in human history, in any time in the past 125,000 years. And this is just causing very, very, very dangerous, profound changes to the climate system and to the currents in the ocean, to the nature of the oceans themselves, their acidity, to the ability of coral reefs to survive. So there is good news in terms of what we're doing in terms of improving our technology, but we have to find ways to scale it up much, much more quickly. And one way that I have suggested to do that is I believe that we should have a national declaration of a climate emergency, just to raise the profile and awareness of this issue, to make people understand that it is not just one of 17 other issues that we ought to attend to but don't really prioritize, but it is a potentially civilization-ending crisis if it's not attended to. We are doing things that are unimaginable in terms of melting the polar ice caps, in terms of altering the very Gulf Stream that keeps England and other parts of Western Europe temperate in climate. And these are, and we're risking the destruction of the tropical rainforest, the Amazon, which is an important part of the climate system and part of the rainfall patterns in other areas. So these are things that we just cannot ignore, even though they're in a sense beyond our field of vision. And most people don't think that they have any ability to influence them, and they tune out. But in reality, here's a critical point. We are de facto funding more powerful hurricanes, more powerful storms, bigger floods, harsher drought. And we're doing it because we're spending maybe $1.3 trillion a year in this country on fossil fuels, on billions of tons of oil, coal, and trillions of feet of natural gas. And we need to repurpose that spending and direct it towards the clean, green, sustainable transition to safe and perpetual energy sources. The fossil fuel industry loves us as customers because it's like a Gillette razor blade. You use it and then you throw it away. Well, with the fossil fuels, you buy it on Monday, set it on fire to go to work or to do whatever you're going to do, and then you have to buy it again on Tuesday and on Wednesday and so forth. We need fuel-free technologies that are clean and safe, but we have to scale them up. And this is where political action comes in, and the nation needs a national clean energy plan with really ambitious targets that recognize this is not kind of a case for business as usual. It's like we're a family and we have a fire in the kitchen, and we have been like going into the living room and turning on the Olympics or turning on a Taylor Swift concert or getting on the internet and telling our neighbors or our friends that the kitchen is very hot. But what we really have to do is freaking break the glass and call the fire department and put that fire out and, you know, deal with this. We cannot keep kicking this can down the road. We have a target right now in this country to cut our emissions by 50 to 52% by 2030. And we are not on track to do it. That's the minimum thing that we ought to do is live up to our commitments. We have rejoined the Paris Climate Agreement, but from day one, that was an agreement that was voluntary, and it was also far too meek and mild to actually protect the climate and make the climate stay within 1.5 degrees centigrade of average heating. We are now in that vicinity already, and we are on a trajectory to go to 2 or 3 degrees. You can just imagine what it would be like to double the heating that we've already had now when we have so much aberrant weather all over the place. So, like I say, we're spending over $1 trillion to buy the energy sources that we really shouldn't be using and don't want. I'm not saying we cut off fossil fuels, but we have to have a much more methodical and far-sighted accelerated transition. That's where the National Energy Plan comes in. That's where a National Emergency Declaration comes in. That's where a fossil fuel mobilization comes in. That's where a Clean Energy Bank comes in. That's where an office to spend, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars on the clean transition, not $40 billion a year. The $369 billion Inflation Reduction Act is over a 10-year period, so that averages out to maybe $37 billion a year. Of that, a lot of it is not going to do anything to reduce the greenhouse gas emissions. Some of it is for technology that actually, frankly, makes no sense. It's like the idea is to strain carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. It's at a very, very dilute concentration, takes a whole lot of energy and a lot of material. And there are many, many better ways to use the money that create a lot more clean energy and that result in a much better climate outcome. So that's some of the money I'm saying is wasted. Some of it is spent on nuclear technology, which we know from over 50 years of experience, in which I predicted and described in 1976, that technology is extremely inherently expensive. And the last two nuclear power plants that were built cost billions of dollars in subsidies. They came in costing $30 billion. And they to get those two reactors done, I think it was about 15 years. Solar and wind are much cheaper, produce much more clean energy per dollar, and can be deployed much faster. There are a lot of regulatory hurdles that still have to be gotten out of the way. And that's why I'm trying to convene a roadblock removal conference that would focus on how do we get these hurdles out of the way.
You know, in between your work, you know, just listening to your trajectory of how you started, it sounds to me in order to get any sort of leverage or positive steps in the right direction or move forward, you had to become an advocate. You had to step up and start doing things, because it sounds like some of the meek policies that have been put in place are really just names. You talked about the, you know, Paris Climate Accord and how these initiatives are really local government initiatives that are important. But are they robust enough to bring change, to regulate? I think we need more financial incentives in some of these green technologies that you were, you know, referencing. But I always think about community. And some of the things that I think is that the power of the grassroots movement is always big, even in urban settings where we could develop some sort of sustainable practices, learn how to do things at a higher level, you know, promote and learn from what some of our indigenous communities have done, protecting their forests and doing things that could improve youth to learn. Because once we are gone, the youth can advocate and create some climate judgment and justice. Because some of the things that we are seeing is that some of this work is still on a broader scope and needs more hands in order to make this move. But I do appreciate the work that you have put in so many years. And I know that there's many people like you who have poured in, but it sounds like we need more. Let's talk a little bit about your book, Solving the Climate Crisis, Frontline Reports from the Race to Save the Earth. Why is this book important? And even though if government changes hands or not, why is this important to the well-being of our planet when they purchase your book?
Well, I think it's very important because it demonstrates the clean technologies that I mentioned, they actually work. And people have been putting them in practice, even in the industries that are toughest to decarbonize, like cement and like steel. They're working on new technologies that, for example, in the steel industry, can avoid using the blast furnace and instead can use clean electricity to electrolyze iron ore and thereby separate it and then process it without a blast furnace, without an oxygen furnace, without burning tons of coal. In the cement industry, you can change the chemistry of what happens within the cement kiln so that you don't produce so much carbon dioxide as a byproduct gas of making the cement itself. And then you can also heat the kiln by burning hydrogen, which you can produce cleanly. It could also be done in theory with electricity, but it's too expensive right now, so people in the cement industry tell me, to do that. But the other kind of edge that you have with cement is that when the chemistry is right, as it solidifies and cures into concrete, certain formulations will take greenhouse gas out of the atmosphere and lock it into the cement and form limestone, which is basically a forever solution until you put it into a kiln and roast it again at 1500 degrees centigrade. So what I'm saying is there are technological solutions, and government needs to make these solutions economically advantageous, because people have sunk costs in older industrial equipment, and they may need some help to cover the first costs of making the transition to a better, cheaper, and cleaner technology. Even though it's sitting right there, there's this hurdle. They have a blast furnace or they have some other technology that they've put hundreds of millions of dollars into. So that's one thing that the book shows you, examples throughout industry. It shows examples of industries that are making chemical products without fossil fuels, just by using materials of biological origin. I talk about people who are saving forests, which are actually storehouses of carbon. Carbon is the main constituent in carbon dioxide that causes global warming. So if we have healthy forests, they will suck carbon out of the atmosphere and store it in trees and in the roots and in the soil. And we want that. We don't want to incinerate our forests, so we have to stop the wholesale destruction of tropical forests in the Amazon and elsewhere. Mm-hmm. You could have a whole other program about that. But I do feature people in the book, like farmer Gabe Brown, who's in North Dakota, and he has found a way to farm using regenerative agricultural techniques that maximize the capture of carbon dioxide in the soil through the plants. and the plants will then incorporate the greenhouse gas into their tissues. And as the roots penetrate deep into the soil and eventually die, that carbon becomes locked in the soil. But carbon dioxide in the, you know, in the plant itself and in the soil is like a fertilizer, and it is necessary for the plant to conduct its photosynthesis, through which it makes sugars out of the carbon in the air and the oxygen and water that that it draws from the rain and from the ground. So thereby the whole ecosystem becomes healthier with more energy, and with more energy input, it takes more nitrogen out of the air, and it becomes more available to plant roots. So the plants become healthy. Animals become healthy that graze on the plants. People are healthy who eat the healthy plants and eat the healthy animals if they're not a vegetarian. So anyway, there are whole technologies based around regenerative agriculture and based upon using natural compost to fertilize the soil, to jumpstart the soil ecosystem so that it becomes like a battery that charges itself with greenhouse gases from the atmosphere and stores it deep in the soil. And that can be permanent storage depending on the details of the situation. So there are ways in which sound and wise, farsighted state, local, and federal policy can stimulate all of this activity. And what I show in the book is I look at every major area of the economy, transportation, buildings, agriculture, industry, commerce, and I show that we have the technology and it's working now and it's cost effective and we just need to scale it up. And then at the end of the book, I summarize the policies that are necessary and that will rapidly and radically scale up these technologies so that they become the dominant technology, not, you know, just one shining example here and there.
Fascinating information. And for one, I keep hearing that advocate in you step up. It's like part of you is like, I got the science part down, but it's not enough. I think I still need to keep pushing. And I do respect that. That whole human element, you know, element to me is what sticks out, that there's an impact that we can do. Because when I think of the bigger names and I think about government, that's an ongoing battle. But I think that through the stories that you shared of the individuals, such as the farmer and the communities where you have traveled, you have experienced some of the consequences of this, you know, degrading, if you will. But you looked at various areas, the raising sea levels, the extreme weather that you talked about, and some of that is really some of that biodiversity. And these narratives come always back to that human concept for me, because I can only think about the things that I can control and things that I can create to bring that solution. So big up to you and to the work that you've been able to do, but I still believe that we as people can mobilize more of this work. I want to dig in a little bit to this call for action. There are three areas of action. Technology, you have the ecological, and there's a social dimension. Can you explain to us these three areas again? Technology, ecological, and the social dimensions, and why are they important in this plight for us to save the Earth?
Sure. Well, when I talk about social, I'm really talking about political, I'm talking about economic, I'm talking about legal, I'm talking about institutional, I'm talking about everything human. When I'm talking about the technological, I'm talking about bells and whistles and thermostats and engines and, you know, efficiency and things like that. And when I'm talking about the ecological dimension there, I'm talking about using natural climate solutions, using the soil, using wetlands, using forests, using these tools of nature in order to accelerate the removal and the storage of gases that are destabilizing the climate in the atmosphere and putting them in the soil where they can abide for millennia and not cause any damage, and in fact can do good to the plants. Now, about the institutional, political, and social dimension, we can do a great deal in the political dimension. We just need to be very engaged with other like-minded people and organizations. We don't have to invent the wheel, so to speak, if we want to have political influence on climate change. There is a raft of organizations out there already working on this issue. So the first thing to do would be to get together with other people who are already working on the issue and join forces with them. Next, you must vote, and you also must know your representatives and find out their position on issues having to do with the climate, and make sure that they are on the right side of these issues, and tell them what you want them to do, ask them to take a stand, and if they don't take a stand, let them know that if they are not representing climate protection and safety and clean air, clean water, and a future for our children, that we're not going to vote for them, and that we will keep track of what they're doing, and we'll interact with them, go to their town hall meetings, call their offices, do that multiple times, and let them know that this is a so-called salient issue for us as voters, and that this is not priority number 17. This is really a top priority issue. And it also disproportionately affects low-income people and low-income communities. And these are the communities that tend to be fence-line communities, that tend to be living near the polluting refineries and the polluting fossil fuel chemical plants. And so these are the folks that are driving the older, more polluting cars, and that are living near the highways, and they're getting worse air quality. And as we know, worldwide, up to 11 million people die every year from exposure to fossil fuel air pollution. It's largely caused by fossil fuels, and hundreds of millions of people are made sick from it. So in addition to spending this tremendous amount of money that I described earlier on fossil fuels, we're also not only buying more extreme weather, but we're also buying this tremendous health cost and environmental cost from the burning of fossil fuels. And as I said, it's disproportionately impacting lower income communities. They also tend to be much hotter. They have fewer trees, and there's less air conditioning in those areas. So for reasons of social and environmental justice, we have to address this issue and make it a top priority issue. It is a life and death issue for people and for the planet and for the future and for our children. And it's very hard to understand how oil industry executives and other people in the fossil fuel industry seem to just not be moved by that and not join forces with the effort to make a transition. It's not that people in clean energy did not want to collaborate and have the fossil fuel industry transform itself and begin investing in clean energy, but they just resolutely didn't do it. They made a few little forays into it and then backed out. I guess the bottom line was the bottom line. They didn't make as much money on solar collectors or wind turbines as they can by selling the fuel that we burn. And so that's where they, you know.
We see tons of, you know, development. We see money in development. Cities just seems like a building keeps coming up. And none of the underlying things that you talked about were ever solved. Unfortunately, life keeps moving on. And I guess that on the agenda, government or decision makers have just looked the other way when it comes to this, but I'm sure that they get it because we saw it in fracking. We have seen it in different areas, and there's a need and how you balance that. Some of it sometimes take us to points that we have to think about some of the areas that are doing the right thing, right? That we are thinking about areas that are probably moving towards a positive, but the technologies that you talked about are developed. They're just not being implemented at a higher level. And we're seeing some of this in some ways, you know, renewable energy and these sources such as solar. I see more homes using, you know, solar roofing and making the move and really using nature to support. But I don't think that there is enough, and I am with you. There could be a call to action to have more government involvement in order to change the tide, if you will, because there are things that are very difficult. You have completed extensive research around the world, and some of the regions that have been, you know, affected the most and least in climate change, and you've done a lot of work for decades around this. Can you share with us which regions, to your last recall, are doing really well, and how do they compare to the United States or America? And, you know, in terms of that,
in Scandinavia, they are really ahead of the United States. And Denmark, for example, thought that they would be able to be climate neutral, not in 2050, but in 2025 or so. And they missed that target. But I think that they are probably 80% of the way there. And I think that they revised their target to 2027. They use this kind of national climate plan that I was advocating for the United States, and they apply that to cities like Copenhagen in Denmark and Stockholm in Sweden. So if you want to see the state of the art in terms of reducing greenhouse gas emissions, Western Europe would be the place to go. And yeah. That's a good example. I'm trying to think of the name of a small island that I know about off the coast of Denmark, incidentally. It'll probably come back to me.
At the end of the day, you've already brought information to us that we did not listen to. America is not in the hunt. There are things that we can do, and probably we're not investing more than we should. And I believe that you have seen this happen with your own eyes, where areas where people really took the time and effort. I'm also curious, in your work, did you notice that the air quality impacts mental health? And how much so can you say that that has an impact?
Well, I don't want to pretend to be knowledgeable about the details of the medical impacts of air pollution, but my intuition tells me that it probably would have an impact on your entire spectrum of health indicators. And it wouldn't surprise me if it also affected mental health. I know we tend to feel good when we're out in, you know, clean air and when the environment is healthy. There's even a term that maybe a little bit kind of touchy-feely, but it's called forest bathing, where you go out into the forest and you, you know, soak up the negative ions. I don't claim that there's anything scientific behind it. Maybe there is, but I don't know it. But it's the antithesis to going into a place where the air smells terrible, and you know that you're breathing something that is likely to cause cancer or heart disease, which we know is very closely correlated to air pollution.
Well, we know that all too well here in New York City. We struggled 9/11, the aftermath of that. There's still ramifications to this day. There is still mental health correlated with that. We've also seen what that looks like for first responders who took over a situation just because of instinct, because of their jobs, because they care. And the ultimate price was losing their life. And we saw that in the chemicals that were burning. We don't need to be scientists or experts in that area to see that there is a correlation with your well-being when you breathe or inhale things that are not safe. So we are probably trekking in areas that we're probably not versed, but we do understand that there is a correlation of negativity that is tied to that. What are things that our listeners can do immediately to improve their lifespan just by helping the environment be better? What are things that you think?
I can think of a couple of things. I think instead of relying on, you know, your car, if you have a car, or taking some type of vehicle, walk or use a bicycle. Get good exercise. It's good for the environment, and it is statistically shown to extend lifespan. In places like Copenhagen, they've done studies, and they find that people that are riding regularly every day live 5 or 7 years longer. So it may take you a little bit longer to get where you're going, but I guarantee it'll be cheaper and that it will be healthier and that likely you'll also live longer. So that's one example of something healthy. I mean, you can also choose to eat organic food if you can pay for it. And there are, I'm trying to think of other things to avoid and things to do. It's actually an interesting question that I haven't given a lot of thought to, and maybe for this reason, because I feel that we have a systems problem here where the whole system is based around fossil fuels, and nearly 80% of all of our energy in society comes from fossil fuel. And we as individuals have somewhat limited sphere of influence on it. We can do things, like I said, when we choose our major energy investments. It's not going to make a hell of a lot of difference if we choose to, not recycle a particular can or something like that. I think recycling is great and important. It turns out a lot of the plastic that we think we've recycled winds up getting burned. And so it's a bit of a bait and switch. But we need system change to change the system. And you only get system change, this higher level and more pervasive change, as a result of political action that uses the power of collective action. These are problems of a collective nature, and therefore an individual can't solve them. You can try to breathe cleaner air. You can try and use an electric cooktop, an induction cooktop at home, so you're not breathing nitrogen oxides from burning natural gas on the range to cook with. That's one thing that you can do that will be healthier, as well as like walking, riding your bike, and so on. But the healthiest thing we can do is to have a healthy political system that addresses these fundamental systemic problems that an individual cannot deal with in isolation. So organize, work with other people, work politically, be politically engaged in elections and in holding elected officials accountable. And if you feel capable of it, run for office and defend the climate from a position of greater political power.
Great stuff, Dr. John Berger. You know, there are many people you have seen from all walks of life. Is there a story that resonates with you that a person or a group that's worked with you in this fight that you remember and acknowledge and say to yourself, I'm appreciative that I took that journey with them, or this person did everything they could and I'm going to continue to uplift their work in this way? Is there such a thing for you, a story that reminds you of all the great things that you've been able to do? Can you tell us about that?
The story of Soren Hermansen comes to mind. And Soren Hermansen is a Dane. And in the 1990s, he was an idealistic vegetable farmer and had been a seaman for years on Norwegian fishing boats, which sailed not too far from the island of Samsø off the coast of Denmark, where he was born and raised. And after being kind of a knockabout the world for a while, he came back to Samsø. And at that time, in the late 1990s, the island was not doing terribly well economically, and it was spending inordinate amounts of money on imported oil for heating and for energy. And thanks in large part to Soren's work and to an organization that he started called the Samsø Energy and Environment Organization, which is now Samsø Energy Academy, they began the conversion of the economy of the island from reliance on imported expensive oil to reliance on natural wind power and on heat that they got by burning straw that the farmers harvested, and also by geothermal heat pumps and by district heating, which meant that they could cost effectively share heat amongst the neighborhood of people who were connected to the system. And today, Samsø gets 100% of its power from the sun, from the wind, and from the earth. And the only thing that uses anything other than clean power is a hybrid electric natural gas ferry that is probably retired by now. When I wrote, it was the last holdout of fossil fuels on the island. And this economy, which had been in the doldrums, really perked up, and local plumbers got to build the district heating system, and farmers got a new market for the straw that they didn't need. And the wind turbines that were built by the community and the investment of the local people brought in money that supercharged the economy. And not only do they not have to import oil, but they actually export clean power and they get credit for it. So whereas in the United States, on average, each person produces 15 metric tons of CO2 emissions per year, in Samsø, each person produces the equivalent of minus 12 metric tons of CO2, because they're creating clean power and they're avoiding burning fossil fuels. So it's a total win-win situation. And of course, you speak about health. It's a healthier environment. There's less air pollution. So this is a little microcosm, but it shows what can be done. Now, obviously, you're not going to use the same approach that you used in Samsø in Manhattan or Flatbush, but there are regionally appropriate ways of converting each economy to reliance on clean energy. And there also has to be good interconnection between the renewable energy resources of a region, so that when it's sunny in one area and maybe there's no sun somewhere else, and some of the electricity from the solar power plant over at point A can move to point B, or when it's windy in point C, it can transfer needed power to someplace where the sky is dark and there's no solar power. Do you see what I'm saying? There's a way.
It's a beautiful story. And to me, I'm just listening to humans. When they are pushed to a certain level, they come together, they create genius. This is an amazing story and a win-win, as you shared, that has helped and is still developing and still making history in this industry, but also changing the life and the lifespan of people who use this practice. So thank you for sharing that story. before we let you go, the floor is yours. Close out the show. Give us some pointers. Tell us about what we should be expecting. Tell us about your movement and where we're going with this.
Well, I can just tell you that personally, I would like to see a national conference that got people together to focus on what are the remaining barriers to really scaling up and speeding up the transition to 100% clean energy in the United States. That should be our goal. I think that we should have a declaration of a national climate emergency in order to expedite all of that. So I would like to see that happen. I would also like to see and possibly be able to facilitate a meeting of senior leaders within the environmental community in order to find ways for the environmental community to project a more coherent voice to the general public about what needs to be done about climate change, so that the public doesn't just hear the cause of birds and the cause of ducks and the cause of whales and the cause of land preservation, but they understand that the entire environmental and climate community have unified behind a common platform, a simple, easy to understand platform that connects climate change to fundamental kitchen table issues, because it is a kitchen table issue. And when you have clean, efficient energy, your energy bills go down and you have more money to spend on the other things that you need. And when you're not breathing fossil fuel pollution, you're healthier, you're not spending as much money on medical bills. So this is really a very practical thing, and it's good for us to move in this direction. So that's the direction that I'm trying to lean into.
Such an honor to meet you, Dr. Berger. Really blessed us with incredible information, because I think that it all comes back to the teamwork, to the human aspect as to what we can do. We have a shared responsibility to work collectively. It is our values and experiences that make us who we are. They bring us, they bring you to the fight. And if they bring you, they better include us all. Because on the platform it was built, because way too often as people, we were overlooked or labeled. But this is no longer. Our plight and our fight is for anyone and everyone who feels a need to be understood. We are strong as individuals, but unstoppable when we unite. Tune in, friends, to another He's Just a Social Worker show, coming to another town real soon near you. We're out. Dr. Berger, blessings. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. My pleasure to be here. I'm very glad to be talking to you.
Please note that the views expressed here are my own and not a representation of my employers and clients. Thank you for listening. We're always here for you. Just message us and we'll get back to you within 24 hours. Thank you. More than just at He's Just a Social Worker. In memory of my mother, Matilde De La Rosa, this is dedicated to you, Mom. Miss you so much. En memoria de mi madre, Matilde De La Rosa, esto va dedicado a ti, Mamá. Te extraño mucho.